Alrighty, my topic this week is Syracuse plus plus.
Okay.
Which that's the only way I could find to actually narrow it down. More verbosely, it's my thoughts based on, as a starting point, John Syracuse's surprisingly in-depth section on Swift in his recent OS 10.10 review on Ars Technica.
Okay, you got the drop on me here. I haven't read his review yet.
Haven't read the review at all? Well,
not at all.
It makes a certain amount of sense because the review is as long to read as his podcasts are to listen to. So yes. But there is one particular section on Swift. Now, the review itself is 25 pages long. There are three of those 25 pages which are on Swift, which, you know, is about 1/8 or 1/9 of the whole review, which, considering that the review is for normals, it's not for programmers, at least mm-hmm. I don't think, is a surprisingly large amount of space to be given to a programming language. Now, John Syracuse has been doing these in-depth reviews of OS X for 15 years now, almost 15 years. His first one, as far as I can tell, was his review of Developer Preview 2.
Yeah, and I remember that's, I believe it was DP3 that I read his first review of.
Yeah. Now, in at least one of those early articles, he posted, as part of the review, some source code from the mock kernel.
Mm-hmm.
So we know he's coming at it from a programmer mentality, even if it's not specifically meant for programmers. Now, the centerpiece of his three pages on Swift, now, it goes into a lot of detail. It's actually enough detail that I would say that you could send these three pages on to a developer who was not familiar with Apple platforms or with Swift, and they would then come out of that saying, oh, yeah, okay, I have a good idea of what this stuff is. You know, it's a good introduction to that. And he made it such that it actually, you know, it actually works really in both ways. If you're a technically minded person who just doesn't do programming, or a programmer who doesn't know anything about Swift, I think it's as good for both of those. Of course, I can't tell for sure because I am a programmer. But the centerpiece of this section of his whole review was tracing how you can go from high-level abstractions, library-level abstractions in Swift, down to optimized machine code. In particular, how you can go from like two int variables, where int is a type defined in the Swift standard library, added to each other through a plus operator, which is also defined in the Swift standard library, how you can go from that down to the CPU add instruction for two integers, integers of the native type known to that CPU. So you haven't actually read it, so I'm wondering. I wasn't planning on going into more detail and describing it. I'm going to put a link in the show notes for it.
Okay.
But we'll see where we can go. He's got a lot of information in there about this, but I'm just going to go forward with my thoughts on that anyway.
I'd recommend it.
And the first thought was, this really puts into relief weirdness that I had always thought about with n as integer. Because the int type in Swift, which is a library type, mirrors the n as integer type that's been in Objective-C since the first introduction of a 64-bit chip that's been used in one of Apple's platforms now. In this case, it was introduced for the 64-bit support for OS X. But it always struck me as being weird that Apple said, okay, we want you to keep using integers. And of course, n as integer is a type def for int. I guess is it both int on both platforms?
I believe so.
However, exactly how they do it is probably platform dependent, but such that it will be 4 bits on a 32-bit platform and 8 bits on a 64-bit platform.
You mean 4 bytes and 8 bytes?
Bytes, yes. Yeah. I'm going to get those wrong. When I was thinking about this in my head, I made that mistake all the time. I'm going to make that mistake multiple times during this thing. But, you know, who really benefits from that? Do you as a developer actually benefit from them making that larger in 64-bit platforms? And I would tend to say, from my experience using these types, pretty much no. Because it makes it annoyingly difficult if you want to save that value to disk.
Sure.
Because you then have to change your... Because you can't safely say, well, I'll save it as 8 bits for 64-bit and 4 bits for Did I just do it again?
You did again, but I'm not going to correct you anymore.
Because I should just stop saying it in detail. Because you, almost any document that you can create, almost any document you can create, you can send between two computers of these two different platforms and want to be able to use them one from the other. And you can't if you can't read it on one of those two. So what I wound up doing back in the day, back when this was more of a big deal, was, you know, you change your type. So it's no longer, it's not NF integer the way they say you're supposed to. You use int 32 underscore T, uh-huh. was the usual way to do it. Then, okay, now it's going to be 32 bits forever. Well, the reason you can do that is because in almost any of the cases where you, where you're using an integer previously, you're not using a number that's large enough that you actually need to have it be 8 bytes, for the 64-bit platform. Mm-hmm. Because if you really, really did care about numbers that were that big, you probably cared about numbers that were that big on the 32-bit platform as well as the 64-bit platform.
Yeah,
you should probably be using a you know, in 64 underscore T in both places instead of NS integer. There's really just, you know, anywhere where you care enough for large enough numbers, you can't, you just can't say, well, I'm just not going to worry about it on a 32-bit platform. It just doesn't make sense. So again, the only reason you would use that, the only reason you use it for both of those things is if you don't care. And if you don't care, then why do you care that they're different on both platforms? Well, the reason that you care that they're different is the same reason why the int type in Swift does that as well. Apple basically ported that same problem to Swift for you. Hey, wasn't that nice of them? And the reason they did that was because it reduces down to CPU native types when you compile your way down. So if you don't care, you can optimize it down to what the CPU can use directly. And that's, you know, okay, that's why you do it. But it does mean that it's in contrast to other, to, you know, people talk about, and Syracuse talks about, the fact that it's a high-level language. Swift is a high-level language. And yet it's not, in some ways. It's not really a high-level language because it's still relying on these machine-specific types. One of the things about Java, when Java was released, that I remember, is that all of their scalar types, all of their types that were language-native types, all gloriously and evangelically said, we're not going to rely on these machine-specific behaviors anymore. So I remember it being, so there was how many bits there were in the types. There was also how they act when you do overflows, right? And I'm not actually sure how the ints work on Apple's platforms because I mostly just don't care about that. Most of the time I'm using numbers which, if they overflow, that's going to be enough of a problem that I'm going to make sure that that doesn't happen. So I don't care whether it's different between 64 and 32-bit, how they overflow. But, all these C-based languages would say, no, it's machine-dependent. We're using C. It's machine-dependent. What happens to it? Java said, no, it isn't machine-dependent anymore. But then that means you can't compile it down to machine-level instructions. How does Apple deal with it? Well, Apple deals with it, I think, primarily by taking advantage of the fact that it only has a couple of hardware platforms. The 64 and 32-bit are going to act in very specific ways. Java has to work on every platform in the world. Apple's languages only have to work on very few. So that's really how they saved themselves. They didn't save themselves by being a superior abstraction. They saved themselves by taking advantage of the fact that they don't need that.
I wonder if this also has anything to do with the general open sourcing of Swift and other platform support.
I just don't think they care about it. So, no, I don't think that would stop them from open sourcing. I just don't think they've gotten to it yet. Or that there are other issues, which I'm not going to spend any time on. But no, I don't think that would be enough. Now, Syracuse spent a lot of time emphasizing that it's going from a library type down to the CPU. That was something that was worth spending time on thinking about and saying, well, because Apple controls the whole stack, which I'll get to, that you can go from a library type down to the CPU type, in a straight shot. I actually think that's a bit of a distraction. I think that it's more interesting that the reason that they could do that is because they're using static types. So that's thought number two. It doesn't matter how many levels you have to go through to get from your source code down to CPU types. as long as you're using static types and not runtime types. You can do that sort of optimization through as many levels of libraries as you want, because the compiler can know what's involved, and it can reduce it on down. It can machete its way through all sorts of layers of abstraction. And, you know, it takes a lot of time. It's not easy, but they can do it. Whereas if your abstraction, if your type is a class and the class has its own logic for how it stores its data, then you can't boil it down. You can really only boil down something if it's a class that really is just a wrapper around that CPU level type. And anything else just won't get you that. So I think a lot of this other stuff, you know, how many layers there are, what level of abstraction there are. No, you've got to choose one or the other. If you're going to get your performance, you've got to basically say, in the end, whatever you call it, however you dress it up, you're going to use machine-specific types. And if you don't want that performance, or if you want more flexibility, then you're going to give up that performance, one or the other. And what Apple has said is, no, we're going to go for the performance. Okay, so that was pretty much point number three as well. The next thought was something again that Syracuse mentioned. Again, these are all thoughts coming from his article. Mm-hmm. He talked about how Apple's stated goal is to make a language which goes from script level programming, where it's very easy, it's very high level, you don't have to worry about a lot of machine types and anything else, down to a performance system type. But what he really kind of, I'm not sure exactly how he phrased it because I didn't write that down, but he made it clear that he understands that all of that scripting level stuff is really just hiding as opposed to really changing your language. The language is still basically C without pointers, but because all the types are inferred, it looks like a high-level scripting language, but it's not. You're still scripting with C. Mm-hmm. Title. It's just that they hit it. So I'm really curious how that's going to take off, because is that really going to be a stumbling block for people who do want the flexibility of JavaScript or Python or Ruby? And we'll find that when they try to write that way, they can't because the types get in the way. Mm-hmm. So I'll be curious how that goes. Or will people just say, no, this is just how you do it these days. The difficulties of dealing with a highly tech language, a highly static language, we can deal with it. I don't know. And so I did mention before something. Did I mention something about Apple controlling the whole stack? In this case, I think the interesting part is people have always mentioned that Apple controls the hardware and the software, but they didn't really control all levels of it. They were making the hardware, but they weren't making the chips. Well, now they are making the chips. Well, they're still not quite designing the chips from the ground up, but it's their own ARM-based processors now for the iPhone, not for the Mac. Mm-hmm. So like they're A, you know, they've gone from, did it go from like an A1 and snap to A8 now?
No, that was a steak sauce.
Yes, they're very nice, very nice. And so, you know, okay, well, we control our language, but they didn't own the language and they didn't really design the language from scratch. Somebody else had done that. Even Next, I don't think, did that. They got it from somebody else. Well, we don't own the compiler, that's GCC. Well, now they own the compiler as well. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's not quite that simple. There's a lot of competing architectural imperatives involved. Mm-hmm. But they do own it from top to bottom. You can go from the text of your source code file down to the way the bits are moved around on the chip, mm-hmm. all within the same company. Mm-hmm. And you know, Syracuse did emphasize that gives them a lot of freedom, a lot of ways that they can think about this stuff now that nobody else could. Mm-hmm. You know, Microsoft can't. They don't own the hardware. Even though they own the language, they own the operating system, they own the compiler, they don't own the hardware. Who else would there be? As you know, Google doesn't really own the hardware. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And then the last one was, Syracuse did mention how this idea that going from the scripting language to the system language is an impossible goal. You know, he's talked about how it's extravagant, this goal. Now, I think what we've kind of talked about in your Swift episode was how it felt like what was giving was the flexibility of a higher level language, because, you know, they were giving up, dispatch, for example, What I'm interested in this is if something has to give, if they can't be all things to all people, what will give? Now, we kind of, again, we kind of said, well, what's going to give is the flexibility of the high-level languages. Mm-hmm. What I'm thinking about now, though, now that Syracuse has sort of mentioned it, is I wonder if what's going to give, if they're going to find that they can't give you high-level frameworks. You know, again, all the high-level frameworks right now are geared towards Objective-C.
Sure.
I'm curious, because they're not going to say, well, okay, this language is a failure, we're going to give you another language, right? Uh-huh. I don't think they're going to do that. I wonder if what they're going to do instead is just slow down all the transitions. You know, maybe they can't make a language which is so performant and still has, you know, these libraries and things. Maybe they'll keep using C and C++ when they otherwise might, you know, when the goal was not to have to do that anymore. Maybe they'll wind up basically giving the blessing to people continuing to use Objective-C for apps. I don't know. But I'm really, you know, because again, when you think about it, when you realize that they just, something has to give. And we'll see what. Will it be that they'll just put the screws to developers? Because that's what they always do when things, when, you know, when there are difficulties, when there are goals of theirs which should conflict with developers. No, we'll just make the developers' lives more complicated and harder. Maybe, you know, that's what we've been kind of assuming that they would do. I'm curious, maybe that's just not going to work. And especially as they lose more and more market share to Android, as well, I've gone on this route before, I won't go long. You know, more Android apps get made first for Android, will they say, no, we can't put those screws to people anymore with these language, which is just impractical to write apps in? I don't know. We shall find out. But those are my thoughts for now.
I will say that with Apple doing the Core Foundation thing in the Carbon era, it makes sense for like Core Foundation to be in C, right? Because that was what the old Carbon developers, C++, and the Cocoa programmers, Objective-C, could agree on. I was surprised at how long Core Foundation keeps on beating and continues to be written in C, and it's really kind of odd to me. I mean, you can maybe make the case for Core Audio because it has latency concerns, but it's still kind of a mystery to me why there's so much C underneath.
Well, there's C public APIs is one thing. Mm-hmm. I think underneath the hood, I mean, I know that there's C++ in a lot of places for performance reasons.
Sure.
So that's going to still happen regardless. They're going to need something lower level than Objective-C. Now, I think their hope is that will be Swift. But in terms of APIs, yeah, I think the C-level APIs are a historical anomaly that they want to fix it. They want new APIs, and ideally they want them in Swift. Mm-hmm. But that's going to take a long time.
Yeah, there's also you know, API maturity, like what happens when you go through a few versions of your API. Obviously, with Dynamic Dispatch handles that with aplomb, but
they can do whatever they want, though. They can make it such that, yeah, no, I don't know. I know that C++ does have a lot of those issues.
Yeah,
and yeah, no, it's a good question. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll go on to my topic, which is KZ Playground, which are playgrounds for Objective-C.
Ooh, yeah, I heard about that.
yeah. So this is, I know we don't talk about topical things, but this came out, I think, today or yesterday or something like that. But
Yeah, very recently.
Yeah, but we'll make an exception in this case. So obviously with Xcode 6 and with Swift, Apple has made a big deal with playgrounds, and rightfully so. We've talked before how I've wanted a REPL for a long time, and Swift is a pretty awesome environment for that type of stuff. Xcode playgrounds only support Swift. So this programmer, Christoph Zablocki, has created a... Basically, as a GitHub project, you can go download it. I'll put a link to it, called KZ Playground, and it's essentially kind of a playground-ish like thing for Objective-C. And so, how it works is that it relies on another project that's actually kind of old, called DICI for Dynamic Code Injection, which I'll also link to. I think it goes back to like the Xcode 4, maybe Xcode 5 days. So it's not new, but I just never heard of it before. So it's interesting. And it's by Philip Valachinko and Paul Taikalo. And so
look at you with all the pronunciation.
Oh man. I'm sorry to all of you people. Title. from the end user's perspective, what you end up getting in with the DAI CI is you get a new Xcode menu item in the product menu called recompile and inject. And so how it works is that it has basically three facets that and I have a little wiki page that I'll also link to, but I'll give you the kind of the goods right here. It's not that difficult. It's first thing they do is that they proxy Clang, and that they take the original Clang that comes with Xcode and they kind of move it to the side. I think they call it like Clang-original or something like that. And they put their Clang in there. And the only reason why they do this is because they want to be able to capture the compilation flags for a given source file so they can do it again later for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So not too hacky there at all, really. I mean, obviously, this is all hacky, but, you know, unofficial Xcode plugins and all the rest. But.
Yeah, it's going to get worse.
Then there's the dynamic library compiler, which when you use that new menu item, the recompile and inject menu item, what it does is that it figures out what the source file is there, and then invokes Clang on your behalf. And then it basically just compiles that one source file into a dynamic library. And then it places that dynamic library file into your home directory under .dyci. And so every time you hit that recompile and inject feature, basically it's creating a dylib for you of that one class that you've recompiled. And then on the iOS side of things, and this is for the simulator only, that the library waits for changes inside that directory, the .dyci directory that's in your home folder. And when a new file appears, it loads it with the dylib dl open command. And then this seems a little bit weird, but it ends up that you have two instances of the same class. So if you have your class foo and you recompile and inject it, we have two instances, the old foo and the new foo. And what it will do is that it will change all the methods of your current class to the new implementations. So I'm not sure exactly how they're keeping the two separate and how they're – I imagine those kind of walking things and copying method implementations over or something like that. I'm not exactly sure how they're doing that, but somehow they basically sync up the two. And
that is amazing. They do they change the code while it's running so you don't have to kill the app.
Right.
And they add the new code and remove the old code. That is brilliant.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's probably a little bit shaky. I mean, I'm sure it can easily back into cases it can't handle.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the old fix and continue. Which, do you remember that?
I do. I remember how shitty it was. Yeah.
That was Apple trying to work around GCC not doing such a great job with. I mean, it's not their fault. Of GCC, it was GCC is what it is, and that's why they have Clang in the first place, right?
And right, although it's funny that now that there is LLVM, now that they could, in theory, do all this stuff on their own in a less hacky way, they don't do this, leaving it to crazy third-party people to do it.
That's right, yeah. So that's the magic of the DYCI project, and it's pretty cool. And I just installed it on Xcode 6.1, and it's still working. It does have the issue because it does a Clang proxy compiler thing that it needs to be that it makes upgrades. It can be broken by an Xcode upgrade, so they recommend you uninstall it, do your Xcode upgrade, then reinstall it. But I can't say that I've tested it and does work on Xcode 6.1 on OS 10 10.9. I haven't even upgraded 10.10 yet. The KZ Playground project itself utilizes DYCI, and it's just an iPad view controller. So it's basically it's a project. It's available via CocoaPods, and it leverages the infrastructure provided by DYCI that you can. And how it works is that it provides a class called KZP Playground, and what you do is you subclass that class and you implement the run method, and you can have multiple playgrounds per project. In your run method, you have this block of code, and you launch your app in the simulator, And it brings up a timeline, kind of scrollable timeline on your left, and kind of a workspace area on the right that you can actually interact with views and stuff like that. And so you get to do things where it's not as slick as Playgrounds, where everything just kind of shows up automatically, that you actually have to call some library-provided functions if you actually want things to show up in the Playground. The biggie is probably KZP show that knows how to display objects in the timeline. This is how you show things in the timeline. And it knows about CA layers, it knows about UI views, Bezier paths, CG path refs, CG image refs, a bunch of stuff, UI images, and NS string. And it also gives you a feedback mechanism. So you don't have to actually, even though it makes it to the, if there's a, it gets it to a point where all you have to do, there's another little part of the project that will look for even file saves and will automatically reload. But otherwise, you can just invoke that one menu item I was talking about, recompile and eject, manually. But it gets to the point where you can tweak away while your code is running, while your app is running, and see these types of real-time interaction with your code. But it's slicker than that. It provides a way to allows you to interact with your instances without even having to recompile, even though that's how easy it is. It provides a KZP action that allows you to put a button there. So if you want some sort of action where you can hit a button and do something, and also provides sliders so you can slide a slider up and down and work with your real live objects. It also has animation abilities. There was a Hacker News thread on this, and Mike Ash commented on it. There was I think it was Marcel who said this is proof that Apple didn't ship Playgrounds with Objective-C support just for marketing reasons. And Mike Ash, whose comment is at the very bottom of the Hacker News thread, which is sad because it's pretty insightful, that he points out that this is not really a replacement for Swift Playgrounds. I mean, the UI isn't nearly as slick. You're basically running, an iPad app in your simulator, and that's your kind of your playground right there. And that's not nearly as good as having it built in. I think maybe we could get to a point where it's built in, but that's even more hacking. He points out that a big part of Apple's Playgrounds is, and I'm basically quoting him here, is how it shows you the value produced by every line of the code and how many times the loops are executed, and also allows you to view a complete history of the values of any particular variable took on during a loop. It's very hard to accomplish this, and it requires modifying the compiler to output instrumented code, and that's why Swift Playgrounds don't execute very, very quickly. This Objective-C version doesn't do any of that. And so that's a good point, that obviously the Swift Playground support was built from the ground up to do what it does, and it's awesome. But Apple, I don't think, will probably ever do that for Objective-C, and probably for pretty good reasons. Objective-C was not really designed for this use case. I mean, anything that's C-based, it's really hard to pull this stuff off. Even Swift, that kind of designed for the ground up, and kind of with this thing in mind, maybe? I don't know how late Playgrounds were at in the development cycle. But even Swift is, all you're this one unsafe bit cast away, an unsafe pointer that you'll do things that I can't possibly track and won't be able to reload correctly. So, but anyway, I have given it a whirl and I can vouch that it works and it's pretty cool. So I recommend checking it out.
What would you use it for if not just for playing around with it?
So it turns out that the workspace area is really important, that I, Christoph has linked to a Vimeo video. I recommend you watch it as he's kind of playing around with it. That the workspace area, you can load up full-scale UI views in there, and you can attach gesture recognizers. And that with the sliders and effect and buttons is that you can basically work on a chunk of UI in real time and kind of manipulate it in real time. Which is great for complicated user interfaces. I've wanted something like this, especially for like dynamic drawing type stuff, for a while.
Yeah, and I haven't played around with Swift Playgrounds much at all. But one thing that I was told, and I'm not sure if it's completely true, is that in Swift, you can't just import pieces of your project into a playground.
Right.
Playgrounds are really just for code you're writing in the playground itself, which does take one of the main uses I would ever have for playgrounds out of the picture. I want to do what you're talking about doing. I want to be able to play around with the view that I've created outside of having to keep recompiling it and relaunching it over and over and over again. And playgrounds don't let me do any of that.
Yep.
Because all they can do is let you just play around with whatever you can type in right then. It's actually quite disappointing. It might be a good learning tool, but it's not a good testing tool.
Mm-hmm. A couple things there. Number one, that there's actually a tick counter in the iPad app that actually counts the number of times you reloaded. So that way it kind of reminds you of how much time it's saving you on that stuff. just telling you, I'm so great. I'm so great each time, right? The second item is that I know people have done hacks where you can load a dynamic framework, and so the playgrounds pretty much you only at the last time I checked was you only could load Apple frameworks and this came with frameworks, and they figured out a way to load other frameworks of your own creation in there. There are ways around that where you can load your own and stuff like that. But it's not ideal. And you're right. I would still say that the majority of code being written today is probably still Objective-C, and probably will be for at least a little while longer.
For a while, yeah.
And so this Kizzy playground stuff seems like is not meant for production. You're not shipping this to end users. This is meant for you experimenting with your code and running through things. And for that,
breaking Xcode.
That too. I should mention that you can have multiple playgrounds per project. So if you want, so that actually makes a ton of sense. You have multiple classes for each playground, essentially, as you work out ideas, and you can how it indicates the active playground when that gets auto launched for you, auto loaded, is that you just make it conform to the KZP active playground protocol. And if you look at the protocol definition, it's empty. It's just like kind of like the IB action thing, where although it is a protocol, not a pound define. Is this a way of marking this is the one that you should load automatically for me? Yeah. So I think that's kind of clever.
Although calling them playgrounds is a bit confusing. Maybe call them like swimming pools or something, just to make sure you don't. Because, I was playing around with this playground. Like, you're using Swift? No, I'm using Objective-C.
And apparently there's also something about the fact that Christoph has used his initials for KZ Playground. I saw in the Hacker News thread that I don't know is that what's the problem is with KZ is Kazazazan or something, or it's anyway. They didn't actually come out and say what the problem was, but a few of the international people were like, I can't believe he named it this because we have problems with those initials. Okay.
But no, given that Swift Playgrounds don't solve the problems that I have,
right,
might be worth a shot.
Definitely, it seems like it's easy to get into and it's easy to back out of. I think it's worth a shot for you to try it out.
Alrighty. Cool. So we'll see you next time.